COVID-19 revealed some underlying health disparities that we can't ignore anymore. Why are African-American people dying from COVID at the rates that they are? Is it underlying health conditions that were not addressed? Is it access to care for COVID? It could be a combination of everything, all of the above.
Hi everyone, and welcome back to COVID-19 Heroes. I'm your host, Lorraine Schneider, and today I'm speaking with Professor Laura Abrams, who is the Chair and Director of Social Welfare at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. We discuss how our social fabric has been altered by COVID, whether it's the racial inequities that persist, our criminal justice system, or the way social workers will continue to support individuals and families far and wide. In the age of social distancing, there's no better gift than a go gift. What is a go gift? It's a way to give loved ones meaningful, personalized gifts by bringing together friends and family from all over the world. Everyone contributes by writing messages that get added to a personal, private website. One new message gets delivered every day, so the more messages, the longer the gift lasts, and the receiver will always have their own little slice of the internet to look back on. Head to gogift.com/COVID, that is GOGYFT.com/COVID. GoGift, the gift that keeps on giving. Hi, Professor Abrams. Thank you for being on today's show of COVID-19 Heroes. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me.
So you are currently serving as the Chair and Director of Social Welfare at UCLA's Luskin School of Public Affairs. Could you please describe the field of social work and the different specialties/areas of concentration that exist?
Sure. So social work as a profession has been around for over 100 years in terms of a formalized profession. And at UCLA, we offer a master's in social welfare. Other schools also have a bachelor's in social welfare type of program. The field overall is geared toward assisting vulnerable populations in dismantling systems of oppression and marginalization and deep disparities that often drive and result in individuals exhibiting problems. So we deal with individuals who are suffering and families and communities in terms of addressing immediate needs like income, healthcare, and access to services and resources. And at the same time, we also look at how the larger social systems related to childcare, wealth inequality, joblessness, housing, all kinds of systems, how those can be changed to also ameliorate suffering on a larger scale. So at UCLA, we have three main concentrations. One is called health and mental health across the lifespan, which gears social workers to specialize in settings that deal with healthcare and mental health care. Another is child and family well-being, and those are geared towards social workers who want to work in child and family services, for the most part, like child protective services, as well as school social workers. And then we have a concentration in social and economic justice that spans many fields, but is also appeals to our students who want to tackle those macro structures that drive social problems.
A lot of the core functions social workers fulfill take place in person. So how is the field adapting to the new physical distancing requirements set forth due to COVID?
Yeah, it's really interesting. So some social work services are deemed essential services. And those fields, those workers have still been asked to come to work. So people who work at Child and Family Protective Services, for example, DCFS in LA, it's called the Department of Children and Family Services. Those folks have not been relieved from their duties in terms of face-to-face visits with clients. You know, I did this series, Voices from the Frontlines, which interviewed 8 social workers in different settings, 8 of our alumni. And most were still being required to be in their settings in some fashion. However, a lot of social work has moved online. So for example, mental health services are now being provided through venues like Zoom and other video conferencing applications. So it's been an interesting time for social work, just to think about what is our ability to reach clients in a digital age, knowing that a lot of clients don't have access to the technologies that might be able to facilitate an online relationship. What I've heard from social workers who have gone online is that their interactions feel more limited, less connected, and also some families just don't have good technology or Wi-Fi to be able to engage in telehealth services.
Do you think COVID-19 and its myriad of implications will increase the need for social workers over the long term?
Yes. The simple answer is absolutely yes. The caveat there is, you know, where are we going to find the funding for more social workers? So as our public budgets are strained and drained, it will be a series of interesting discussions at the local, state, and federal level as to how we make the market open for more social workers. So it's a bit of a concern.
Similarly, in addition to completing classroom work, MSW students need to complete field placements. How are you preparing for the new academic year? And how will the department's teaching style need to innovate to adapt to distance learning while ensuring that the quality of instruction and practical skills gained does not get affected?
That's a really good question. So when COVID hit and stay-at-home orders went into place in March, we quickly shifted to a remote instructional model for the spring quarter, which is about to end next week. And we also pulled our students out of face-to-face field education placements for the time being. So what that means is that even if agencies were operating in person, we did not permit our students to be face-to-face at agencies or with clients, because at that time, we didn't know the risk. We didn't have any experience with a pandemic and field education. But our students are in field education placements. They are there 2 days a week in their first year, and they're there 3 days a week in their second year. So it's quite a bulk of their education is on the job learning. So what we're doing is we are currently planning our return to the field carefully. We're taking advice from the campus. We're taking advice from the state of California. And we're also taking advice from the National Association of Deans and Directors, which is a group of social work directors all across the country, as well as the Council on Social Work Education. And we are thinking about a safe return to field so long as students are able to maintain social distancing, so long as students are able to have the proper protective equipment needed for direct client contact. And if students are immune compromised or unable to return to the field due to their own childcare needs or other COVID-related reasons, then we can set up for them placements that continue with remote work. So we're in the middle of a complex plan. And also right now we plan to have our fall classes continue to be remote until we get the green light from UCLA that we can return to campus more fully.
We're experiencing quite the pivotal moment. Similar to 9/11, some new practices and standards will never regress to what we knew prior to the pandemic. What are some long-term shifts that you foresee in your area of expertise?
I'm going to answer that question with a couple of different parts. So the long-term shifts. So I think COVID-19 revealed some underlying health disparities that we can't ignore anymore. So when you think about, you know, why are African American people dying from COVID at the rates that they are? Is it underlying health conditions that were not addressed? Is it access to care for COVID? It could be a combination of everything, all of the above. But, you know, what started as kind of this equal opportunity disease has quickly become racialized. And so I think as social workers and public health professionals and generally concerned citizens, we need to think more about how to address those health disparities. And I think that's going to shape the field a bit. I also wonder about post-pandemic, and I know we're starting to return to society gradually, you know, in this time of mutual aid, there's been actually a lot of stories of people banding together, like helping neighbors, delivering prescriptions to elders, local communities organizing food banks. You know, could this also be the start of some type of mutual aid, neighborhood, volunteer associations that could also shape the field? There's been a real, you know, and this has been documented in a lot of literature, there's been a real absence of community networks and the kind of the erosion of the old, you know, helping our neighbors as society has become more and more developed and more technological. So I wonder if things will change. I know, you know, we're starting to think about just today I saw, you know, restaurants are about to open. So things are about to open up, but I wonder if there could be any lessons learned from the pandemic about banding together as a community. And then the third piece is more on the negative side again, or difficult side, is that so many people have lost their jobs and so many people are at risk of houselessness, especially in cities. And, you know, kind of like the Great Depression, is our government going to step in and are we really going to be able to change the social safety net to prevent people from truly falling out, you know, into homelessness? So those are all questions that I'm curious to see what will happen.
A lot of your research focuses on improving the well-being of youth and young adults with histories of incarceration and juvenile justice. What effects of COVID have we seen there?
So that's another kind of depressing outlook, but I'm gonna respond. So in the adult system, especially with county jails, they've been trying to let more people out on bail or bond, or probation, so that the jails aren't overcrowded because COVID is spreading through jails and prisons in a way that people are dying. And there's not a lot of folks who are really caring for those who are imprisoned. In the juvenile facilities, judges are not letting youth out, and they're saying that they're getting testing and quarantine and contact tracing. But any institution, and we've seen this in nursing home, is a hotbed for the spread of the virus. So far, young people, juvenile justice kids, youth are not being let out. There was a bunch of groups that sued the LA County system, and they were denied their petition to release youth by the state Supreme Court. In addition, there's been a number of probation officers and youth in juvenile justice facilities around the country who've tested positive for COVID-19. But there seems to be a lack of will and kind of even public attention to these issues. So in terms of, on the youth side, it's almost like young people they're locked up. We don't really know what's happening, but we know that people are testing positive in facilities. On the adult side and young adult side, even though people are being perhaps let out of jail on bond or parole, we also know that there isn't a lot of places for people to go that are safe. So halfway houses, institutions, and shelters are all also subject to the spread of the disease. And there's not many jobs right now for folks, especially those with a criminal or juvenile record. So it affects my work quite a bit and affects many people's lives. And my colleague and I are currently doing a study where we're looking at folks who have been released from jail or juvenile hall. And we are looking to see monthly checking in with folks to see how they're doing during COVID. So we'll know more as our research continues to collect information.
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. If you're seeing new personal research topics or questions coming out of this.
I am, but there's so many. So my main research is on youth justice and young adult justice. I can see that the practices of institutionalization and the safety of people who are imprisoned is already been fairly dire, but is even more pressing right now because people who are institutionalized, again, are at very high risk for contact with COVID-19, but also for not getting the healthcare that they need. So some of my research questions are about that experience of being institutionalized during the pandemic, but also what's going to happen to folks right now when they come out of prison or juvie or jail? Are they going to have access to any of the services that they're mandated to do by probation? Are they going to have families to house them? What are people going to do to meet their basic needs for food and shelter? So that's kind of where I'm at right now in terms of my research questions.
A question that I like to end with is, who is one of your COVID-19 heroes?
I don't think there's one hero. You know, I think the heroes are the unnamed. There's so many parents out there, you know, children who have disabilities and children who don't have access to their teachers or their aides, or low-income parents who are struggling to make ends meet and still provide for their children. So I think my heroes go out to the moms and dads out there who are doing everything they can for their children, despite, you know, the really grave circumstances that we're in. My heroes are also the social workers, and again, the unnamed people who show up for work every day, who aren't sheltered at home, who know that they're putting their health at risk to help others. And so, yeah, there's a lot of heroes.
Yeah, and I think that's definitely the beauty. One of the good things that we're seeing coming out of this is that there's a lot of people banding together and doing some really wonderful, touching things. So,
yes. So the question is, though, will people continue to do so? So I guess I would encourage folks to think about, you know, in terms of the title of your podcast, too, the COVID-19 heroes, you know, how do we keep this any momentum of generosity and the spirit of community going after this ends?
Well, on that note, Professor Abrams, I can't thank you enough for speaking with me today and for everything that you're doing, educating the next generation of social workers and the important research that you're conducting as well.
Well, thank you for allowing me to be part of your project. I really appreciate it.
I'd like to close off this episode by thanking Professor Abrams and social workers all over for their incredible dedication to helping the most vulnerable. As Professor Abrams said, all of us need to continue showing the generosity so many of us have received over these last few months. We are still in the middle of fighting this virus, and we must keep the momentum going and keep being gracious, supportive, and kind to those around us. If you enjoyed today's episode, feel free to leave a rating or review on your app. You can also follow the show on social media. Just follow the links in the episode description. Stay well, stay healthy. Until next time, I'm your host, Lorraine Schneider.